Welcome back, dear listeners. It's good to have you with us once again here on Iran Radio. As we move forward with today's programming, we invite you to stay with us for a series of thoughtful and enriching segments we've prepared for you. Here's that still to come on your station. To begin, we present Spring of Truth, a program that offers a reflective connection to the roots of the Islamic Revolution. This program features English translation of selected statements and speeches from the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, delivered on various occasions. After that, we bring you Iran Today. If you're looking to stay informed about the current developments within the Islamic Republic, whether in science, technology, the economy, or key national initiatives, this program provides a concise and informative overview of what's happening across the country. Following that, we turn to Minbar, a program that shares insightful excerpts from the sermons and talks of prominent Islamic scholars, covering themes such as ethics, theology, Quranic exegesis, Islamic history, and occasionally contemporary social and political matters. Minbar offers listeners a rich space of contemplation and learning. Then we'll join the panel in Quran Quest, a roundtable discussion addressing your questions about the Holy Quran. With clarity and care, our panelists respond to inquiries received via phone and online platforms, offering guidance and resolving uncertainties about the meanings and messages of this sacred book. Up next, Spring of Truth, we invite you to stay with us. Allah,
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of Truth.
Allah ya Allah subhanallah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allah wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allah ya Allah wallahu akbar.
November 30th, 1979. One of the great points that Quran has is that you notice the repetitions. These are not repetitions. The style of building human being is thus. Every page that you open is invitation to observe piety, invitation to be good, invitation to so-and-so. Another page that you open is the story of Prophet Moses in the Quran, which has been repeated several times. The story of Prophet Abraham is repeated several times. It is not one to narrate a story, which is enough to narrate once. Those that are not acquainted with the Quran, these foreigners do not understand what the Quran is, so they say that it would be good if it was divided into chapters, each dealing with one subject.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. About resistance against oppression and submission to it, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, under the guidance of Prophet of Islam, we want to enforce these two words, neither be oppressor nor submit to the oppression. Well, here Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is talking about the purpose of his revolution, which is something divine and lead to good consequences for people. Our revolutionary Imam rahmatullah alayhi pulled the country out of various morasses with the help of the Islamic revolution, from the morasses of dependence, backwardness, political and moral corruption, and global humiliation. We were suffering in these models. We had become dependent, humiliated, and backward. We were held behind. They held us back in scientific fields, in economic pursuits, technological advancements, on an international presence, and overall in everything. Our magnanimous Imam rahmatullah alayh changed the direction within Iran, and thus bringing about a profound transformation, he changed the path of Iranian people. He changed the trajectory we were on, and he moved us towards lofty goals. These goals which guided us with the help of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, and that guided the Iranian society towards the revolution, were extremely important. The sum of all of these goals is the authority of God's religion. The authority of God's religion calls for social justice in real sense of the world. It calls for uprooting poverty, ignorance and oppression. It calls for preparing a collection of Islamic values. It calls for uprooting social detriments. It calls for providing physical, moral and spiritual health and scientific progress for the country. It calls for offering national dignity, national and Iranian identity, and international power. It calls upon man to activate the capacities that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given this land, and all these terms are included in the authority of God's religion. And this was Imam rahmatullah alayh who moved us towards this path. Thank you very much for listening to us, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
For nearly two decades, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has been met with relentless opposition from the West. Pressure came in many forms, endless negotiations that went nowhere, punishing sanctions, and even military action. When Israel and the United States struck Iranian nuclear sites with uncertain results, the European trio, France, Germany, and Britain, stepped in with their own strategy, activating the so-called snapback mechanism. On August 29th, they triggered the countdown for the automatic return of UN sanctions on Iran. The move was immediately welcomed in Washington and Tel Aviv. But what exactly is snapback? Why does Iran reject it? And what does this showdown reveal about Europe's role in the nuclear dispute? France, Britain, and Germany, the three signatories of the JCPOA, have now activated the snapback mechanism. This mechanism has always hung over Iran like the sword of Damocles, suspended and ready to drop. And despite the fact that these very countries have repeatedly violated the deal themselves, it was entirely predictable that they would not abandon such a pressure tool against Iran. Just a short while ago, when U.S. President Donald Trump, the man who tore up the JCPOA back in 2018, demanded new talks with Iran, these three European states stood on the sidelines. They remained silent, despite being part of the very agreement Trump shredded. Only after Washington and Tel Aviv launched illegal attacks on Iranian facilities did the European Troika resurface. And their first priority was not reviving the nuclear accord, but weaponizing it, invoking snapback to pile on sanctions. To critics, it looked less like diplomacy and more like appeasement, a way to curry favor with Washington rather than to uphold an agreement they themselves had failed to honor. Iranian MP Mr. Ismail Kosari, a member of the National Security Commission in Parliament, Mr. Kosari told us allegiances can speak louder than treaties, sometimes louder than reason itself.
Unfortunately, these three European countries and others both inside and outside the region do not take any action without U.S. approval. In effect, they are simply America's followers. This is not an independent policy. It is exactly what Washington wants. Their hostility intensified after the recent 12-day war, when they failed to achieve their objectives against us. They sought to weaken and even divide Iran, but by God's grace, they did not succeed. Having failed, they are now resorting to these political maneuvers.
The term snapback refers to the automatic reinstatement of sanctions against Iran. It is in fact a legal and diplomatic process under UN Security Council Resolution 2231. That resolution endorsed the 2015 nuclear agreement between Iran and six world powers. That is five permanent Security Council members plus Germany. With its adoption, six earlier resolutions that had imposed sweeping sanctions on Iran were lifted. Now, with the activation of the snapback mechanism, those same six resolutions are set to be reimposed. The snapback doesn't just mean sanctions. It means the automatic return of six hard-hitting UN Security Council resolutions. Resolution 1696 in 2006, demanding Iran suspend uranium enrichment. Resolution 1737 in 2006, banning sensitive nuclear activities and restricting technology transfers. Resolution 1747 in 2007, escalating financial and arms restrictions. Resolution 1803 in 2008, targeting banks, cargo inspections, and imposing more travel bans. Resolution 1835 in 2008, reaffirming earlier demands. Resolution 1929 in 2010, the toughest of them all, comprehensive arms embargo, major banking and shipping restrictions. Together, they represent the harshest era of sanctions Iran has ever faced, an era the JCPOA was supposed to end, not revive. Mr. Kosari said when the accuser forgets their own record, the debate becomes theater.
They are exaggerating this issue far beyond what it merits. Legally, the real question is why they themselves failed to honor their commitments. Instead of being held accountable, they now act as if they're above the very agreements they drafted and approved. As far as I can tell, the matter is not as significant as they claim. Yes, they have imposed sanctions on us, and now they speak of reactivating UN sanctions and similar measures. But in substance, it's not a major development. The real impact is psychological, not practical. Economically, they think these pressures will cripple us, but that is not the case. We know how to continue our work and how to adapt, so the damage will be limited.
Europe says Iran failed to uphold its commitments. Tehran replies, not true. Every step it has taken, it insists, was allowed under the deal itself. Article 36 of the JCPOA is clear. If one party leaves or others fail to deliver, Iran has the right to scale back its commitments. The United States walked out in 2018. Europe promised to fill the gap and failed. So when Iran reduced compliance, it says it was acting within the agreement, not outside it. International law supports that position. The Vienna Convention states, a party that breaks its own obligations cannot hold others accountable. By that standard, it is Europe, not Iran, that stands in violation. We also talked to Dr. Mohsen Abdullahi, Associate Professor of International Law at Sheikh Beheshti University. We asked him to put the European Troika's move into legal perspective.
According to Articles 36 and 37 of the JCPOA, a state wishing to refer a compliance dispute to the UN Security Council must first exhaust several layers of dispute settlement. The issue must begin in the Joint Commission. If unresolved, it proceeds to the level of foreign ministers and may also be reviewed by a three-member advisory panel. Only after these steps can a participant state decide either to limit its own commitments or to bring the matter before the Security Council. The European Troika has not observed these procedures. In their 8th of August 2025 letter, they asserted that they had already triggered this process in 2020. However, as both Russia and China emphasized in their formal correspondence, the matter remained unfinished and the prescribed sequence was not completed.
And there's another twist. After Israeli and American airstrikes left Iranian nuclear facilities badly damaged, Europe is now citing violations of a program that in many respects no longer exists in its original form. Tehran calls that claim absurd. How can you enforce obligations on centrifuges that were bombed into rubble? Then there's procedure. With the United States gone, the JCPOA's joint commission is incomplete. Filing a snapback complaint without it, Iran argues, is legally hollow. Russia and China agree, telling the UN Security Council that Europe's action is unlawful and contrary to both the JCPOA and the international treaties it rests upon. And Europe's record doesn't help its case. Remember Instex, the mechanism unveiled with fanfare in 2019 to keep trade flowing? Iran considers the activation of the snapback mechanism as unlawful. What legal evidence does Iran have to support this claim?
Following the U.S. withdrawal in May 2018, the European parties failed to honor their own obligations. They neither lifted economic sanctions nor facilitated normal trade, banking transactions, or access to SWIFT. Their proposed mechanism, INSTEX, collapsed without delivering results. Moreover, in 2023, the eighth year of the agreement, they were required to undertake specific legislative measures at the EU level, but did not. Thus, the European states are in breach both procedurally and substantively. From a legal perspective, they lack the standing to invoke the snapback mechanism. Iranian officials have also argued that by consistently disregarding the agreement, these states have forfeited their status as JCPOA participants and therefore cannot claim rights reserved for participants.
According to reports, until January 2020, not a single transaction was carried out through INSTEX. Only in March 2020 did one limited deal take place. The export of medical equipment worth £500,000 from Germany to Iran. That amounted to just 0.003% of the £1.5 billion in trade between the two countries in 2019. In January 2021, Iran's central bank declared that the lack of courage by European states in exercising economic sovereignty and their inability to finance INSTEX was the main reason for the mechanism's failure. Meanwhile, giants like Total, Siemens, and Airbus fled the Iranian market under U.S. pressure. Instead of relief, Iran got new restrictions, so-called human rights and missile sanctions targeting individuals and institutions. All of this, critics say, is in direct contradiction to the spirit and the letter of the nuclear deal. The bottom line, the current crisis is not the result of Iranian defiance. It's the direct result of broken promises by Washington and Europe. The United Nations resolution endorsing the JCPOA demanded full compliance. Instead, America walked away, Europe stood aside, and Iran, under maximum pressure, was left to fend for itself. Mr. Hanif Ghaffari, an international affairs analyst based in Tehran. According to Mr. Ghaffari, in global politics, context often overrules the text. To what extent do you think that this move carried out by the three European countries was an independent move rather than the result of U.S. pressure?
In international relations, every phenomenon has both a textual and a contextual dimension. The textual dimension pertains to treaties and formal agreements, such as the 2015 nuclear deal, JCPOA. The contextual dimension reflects the political realities that dominate these texts, effectively making the textual provisions a dependent variable shaped by broader political considerations. This principle has always applied to Iran's nuclear file. The JCPOA has always had a stronger political than legal dimension. The behavior of the Obama administration prior to the U.S. withdrawal and the subsequent actions of the Trump administration clearly demonstrate that political considerations have consistently outweighed legal ones. European states operate within this same context. Germany, France, and the UK, along with other EU members, position themselves as politically aligned with Washington due to security ties within NATO and economic and infrastructural linkages. Thus, we cannot treat Europe as independent of the US, and the activation of a snapback mechanism should be seen as a political, not purely legal action.
The principle of good faith enshrined in the UN Charter and the Vienna Convention is supposed to govern all treaties. But when Europe itself has acted in bad faith, can it really invoke the snapback clause with credibility? Even European diplomats admit this is their last card. Play it and there's nothing left. Instead of making Europe stronger, it risks making them irrelevant. Iran once saw the Troika as mediators. Now it sees them as messengers. And the cost of pressure, Tehran warns, will be steep. We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news highlights. Mehr News: Iran to make proportionate decisions if snapback invoked. VP: Iran's first Vice President Mohammad Reza Arif says that if snapback mechanism is activated by the three European powers to return the sanctions on the country, Tehran will make proportionate decisions. Speaking in a cabinet session on Sunday, Arif emphasized that Iran has always managed to move within the framework and specified strategies of the governance in the face of sanctions imposed against the country. He said that the European countries, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany lack the authority to invoke the snapback mechanism. Once the snapback mechanism is triggered, Iran will make the proportionate and necessary decisions, he underlined. IRNA: Iran entitled to respond to E3's unreasonable snapback move, ex-Pakistani envoy. Iran has every right to respond to the recent move by the European Troika to trigger the snapback of sanctions, says a former Pakistani ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, describing the step as unreasonable and aligned with Washington's unlawful conduct. Ali Sarwar Naqvi, executive director of the Center for International Strategic Studies, said in an exclusive interview with IRNA that the attempt by France, Germany, and Britain to restore UN sanctions reflects the same bias and unfair attitude of the Western bloc against Iran. He added that the European parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are following in the footsteps of US President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018 during his first term. Their behavior is completely prejudiced and duplicitous, Naqvi noted. The former ambassador argued that the European approach undermines prospects for the peaceful resolution of Iran's nuclear issue, saying they are attempting to impose their will on Tehran with negative intentions. Naqvi emphasized that Iran's positions against such reckless measures is legitimate, stressing that Tehran is entitled to any reciprocal response to protect its national interests. He concluded that while Iran upheld its commitments, the U.S. and Europe repeatedly failed to honor theirs, instead choosing a negative and unreasonable path. Reuters: Iran ready to resume fair nuclear talks if West shows goodwill, foreign minister says. Iran is ready to resume fair negotiations over its disputed nuclear program if the West shows goodwill, Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi said on Thursday, hours after three European powers triggered the process to reimpose UN sanctions on Tehran. Araghchi reaffirmed Iran's readiness to resume fair and balanced diplomatic negotiations on the condition that the other parties show seriousness and goodwill and avoid actions that harm the chances of success, he said in a letter sent to European Union Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas. Tehran Times: NPT and diplomacy will be dismantled after snapback activation, sources tell Tehran Times. A high-level informed Iranian source has told the Tehran Times that activating the disputed snapback mechanism to reimpose UN sanctions on Tehran would force a very strong reaction from Iran, deal a serious blow to global non-proliferation efforts, and permanently destroy the path of diplomacy. The source, speaking on condition of anonymity, said Western states have miscalculated Iran's resolve and operate under the perception that Tehran would not respond forcefully to such a move. We consider leaving the snapback unwavered as a path towards greater tensions, the source said. While Iran previously said it would leave the NPT Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, if the snapback were triggered, it now appears to believe such a move would mean it should no longer negotiate its nuclear program with the West. With the activation of the snapback mechanism, neither Iran's economy nor the internal unity will be destroyed, but the negotiations will certainly be destroyed, the source said. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative. Iran's policy toward Europe's attempt to trigger the snapback mechanism is clear. Based on the JCPOA itself and international law governing treaties and agreements, Iran considers this action to be illegitimate and unlawful. Russia and China agree. Both have formally declared Europe's action unlawful, stressing that only a fully functioning JCPOA joint commission could consider such a complaint, and that commission has been dysfunctional since Washington's exit. Mr. Ghaffari said history is rarely static, and perceptions evolve faster than treaties. To him, Iran is now in a more favorable position than 10 years ago, no matter how much the West has tried to undermine its status in the world. What do you think would be the repercussions of this action carried out by the three European countries? Do you think that it would result in a general consensus against Iran, or is the situation different this time?
The international environment in 2025 differs significantly from the pre-JCPOA period. Previously, many states and publics viewed Iran as a maximalist actor on nuclear issues. Today, observations of Iran's conduct through the Obama, Biden, and now Trump administrations demonstrate its flexibility, good faith, and responsible behavior. This evolving perception is reinforced by the abstentions of China and Russia in Security Council votes on multilateral sanctions, indicating broader international acknowledgement of Iran's position.
The legal case against snapback is substantial, but is law really what's driving Europe's decision? Talking from experience, the answer is no. Yet, Dr. Abdullahi believes that Tehran can still beat the odds and succeed in its showdown with the West.
The Security Council lacks an independent enforcement arm and relies on member states to implement its resolutions. This reality underscores the importance of Iran's diplomatic engagement with the broader international community. If Iran can effectively demonstrate the illegality and illegitimacy of reimposed sanctions, many states may be reluctant to implement them, limiting enforcement largely to Washington's closest allies. In addition, Iran could pursue a request for an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice. Such an opinion would provide authoritative legal arguments to undermine the enforcement of any reinstated resolutions and could exert both legal and political pressure on the Council.
Iran had already warned the three European countries that such a biased and unlawful move would carry consequences. Iranian officials had stated that cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency would be impacted and could even come to a halt. Soon after the European Troika's action, Iran's parliament announced that it would immediately motion a table calling for withdrawal from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and its additional protocol. For Iran, the message is clear. Activate snapback and you risk dismantling what little cooperation remains. Critics in Tehran see Europe's move not as strength, but as desperation. After decades of sanctions, Iran has learned to adapt. Even Western analysts concede that most of the economic damage has already been done. The ceiling of sanctions is already reached, said former U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. If the economic impact is minimal, then snapback becomes a psychological weapon,
propaganda meant to exert extra pressure, even as Europe's influence wanes.
Do you think that the activation of the snapback mechanism indicates the end of the JCPOA?
The JCPOA included sunset clauses that gradually removed restrictions. For example, lifting the arms embargo in year 5 and ending missile-related provisions in year 8. By year 10, the 6 prior UN sanctions were intended to expire permanently. Yet the JCPOA contains no explicit termination clause. It does not address what happens if neither side fully implements the agreement. This legal gap creates risks. Should the sanctions return after the 30-day process, expected in October 2025, Iran might simultaneously face old UN obligations while still being treated as bound by the JCPOA. To avoid this outcome, a clear legal strategy is necessary. Iran should issue a formal declaration of termination or withdrawal, affirming that the agreement no longer has legal effect.
Iran will not accept being treated as an exception to international law. If the West insists on zero enrichment, there will be strong resistance. If, however, their concern is simply to ensure that Iran never builds a nuclear weapon, there is room for dialogue. Tehran has made it clear any return to negotiations would be negotiations under arms. In other words, Iran will keep its finger on the trigger because trust in the other side simply doesn't exist. There are plenty of reasons for Iran's deep suspicion of their intentions. The three European countries have given Iran 1 month to comply with three conditions: restore full IAEA access, reduce enriched uranium stockpiles, and most controversially, enter direct talks with the United States. That last demand exposes the hollowness of Europe's position. By conditioning sanctions relief on bilateral U.S.-Iran talks, Europe effectively sidelines itself. Once seen as mediators, the Troika now look more like messengers for Washington. Iran, along with Russia and China, has pushed back. In a joint letter to the UN Secretary General, the three foreign ministers, Abbas Araghchi, Sergei Lavrov, and Wang Yi, denounced Europe's move as both legally baseless and politically destructive. The implications are profound. By weaponizing snapback, Europe risks burning its final card in the Iran file. Any hope of acting as a credible intermediary has all but vanished. And in the bigger picture, Europe may have dealt a blow not only to Iran, but to its own security interests in West Asia. For years, European capitals have insisted they were guardians of diplomacy, defending the nuclear agreement against American sabotage. But by activating snapback, they've revealed a different reality, one of weakness, inconsistency, and subordination. Iran sees it as proof that the West does not seek resolution, only leverage.
Iran's legal stance draws on precedent, such as the 1970 UN resolution regarding Namibia and rests on customary international law and judicial practice. The principle is that a party that fails to meet its commitments cannot invoke other provisions to assert claims. Applied to the JCPOA, European states that fail to lift sanctions, impose arbitrary limitations, or support U.S. military interventions cannot legitimately activate Articles 36 and 7. Additionally, the Brussels Agreement, issued after the U.S. withdrawal, contained 11 commitments from the EU to facilitate Iran's trade, energy, and shipping needs while keeping Iran in the JCPOA. These commitments largely failed in practice, culminating in the non-functional and largely symbolic INSTEX mechanism. This demonstrates that Europe has not fulfilled either its Brussels commitments or its obligations on the JCPOA precedents, strengthening Iran's legal and political position.
And Europe, in its bid to matter again, may have made itself irrelevant. Because in the end, the snapback mechanism, or in a better word, snapback machination, may not snap Iran's resolve, but it may snap Europe's credibility instead. Mr. Kosari made it clear that the West should mind its P's and Q's, as even Iran's patience has a breaking point. Does the parliament have any plans or strategies in order to counter the reimposition of sanctions against Iran?
The parliament has already taken certain steps, and if Europe continues down this path, we will have no choice but to consider leaving the NPT. We have so far acted with patience and restraint, trying to avoid such a move, but if they insist on using the snapback mechanism to pressure us, we will certainly take that step. This matter is under active discussion, including in the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission, with the foreign minister and other officials. If we reach that conclusion, we will act accordingly.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Until next time, take care.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life. a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani.
Every one of our imams was dealing with a different era and a different situation. The time of the sixth imam was very unique and it is very special for us, mainly because if you were to look at the time of the sixth imam, you would find many commonalities between his time and the times that we are going through and the times that we are living through. It was not a time of open oppression. People had the ability to practice their faith. It was not like the time of the Prophet early on in Mecca. At the same time, there was hidden forms of oppression. You find in the time of the sixth imam, there are still many times where the imam is worried and cautious about what he teaches to his companions. In the midst of all of this, the sixth imam utilized this opportunity and this switch from the time of Bani Umayyah to the time of Bani al-Abbas to promote the teachings of the Shia school of thought. One thing that you will notice in Islamic history as you go from the first dynasty to the second dynasty, when you go from the time of Bani Umayyah to the time of Bani al-Abbas, is that you find Bani Umayyah were not fans of knowledge. They were not fans of teaching and preaching. They were not fans of libraries. They were not fans of universities. Bani al-Abbas, on the other hand, were the exact opposite. Though they had their own wrong intentions, they were big fans of knowledge, of debates, of libraries, and of universities. And the sixth imam utilized this opportunity and this openness that he had been afforded to preach the teachings of the Shia school of thought. But make no mistake, because the reality is, if you want to teach a particular school of thought, there have to be those who will accept and receive that knowledge from you. And this is where the students of the sixth imam, or if I use a better term, the disciples of the sixth imam, come into the picture. Because not everyone who came and sat in a gathering where the sixth imam was preaching was at the same level in terms of his acceptance of what the sixth imam was teaching. There were those who simply came to see what he had to say. They saw him as a scholar amongst other scholars. Then you had disciples. They came to fundamentally accept and receive what he is preaching. Tonight, inshallah, we want to delve into the lives of disciples of the sixth imam and see what lessons we can learn from the personal lives of these individuals. The first of those individuals that we find in the life of the sixth imam is Zurara ibn A'yan al-Kufi. The name of Zurara occurs in 3,000 narrations. Now, it's a sad reality that when we mention these names, and I speak of myself, for many of the Shia, these names are not even familiar. Ask a Shi'i if he knows Bukhari and Muslim. He definitely knows Bukhari and Muslim, doesn't he? He knows Tirmidhi too. He knows this, he knows that. Ask him if he knows who Zurara is. All of us say, I don't know who Zurara is. But he narrated 3,000 narrations. Yeah, but we don't take time to even understand who this individual is, yes? Zurara ibn A'yan al-Kufi. He came from a family called the family of Ali A'yan. This family, top-notch family. You know some families, you see them. From that family come scientists, engineers, amazing people. This is how Ali A'yan were. Zurara had a very special status in the eyes of the Ahlul Bayt. Why? How did he reach this status that the fifth imam and sixth imam constantly used to speak about him? They constantly used to praise him. They constantly used to protect him from threats and dangers that were coming his way. Because Zurara was not the type of person who would just sit there and look at the sixth imam and see what he says and say, okay, inshallah, if I remember this, I'll pass this on. This is not how he narrated hadith. How did he reach that status? This is how he did it. Zurara had a couple of important characteristics. The most important of all was work ethic. What Zurara did, whatever he did it in the best possible way. He's going to narrate hadith, but he wants to protect this hadith. He wants to pass it on for generations. He wants to leave a heritage for the Shia. So Zurara was the type of person, though he was in Kufa, he was from Kufa. Kufa is in today's Iraq, yes? And the imam most of the time was where? In Medina, in today's Arabia. Yes? How far of a distance that is. That's a very far distance. But Zurara would put on and take on the burden of traveling from Kufa all the way to where? To Medina, to hear hadith directly from the lips of the sixth imam. This is what made him so special. The sacrifices that he made on the way. So there were those who would stay in Kufa. They would wait for people to come back from Medina and share what the sixth imam was preaching. Yes? That's why the narration says, at one point, if you entered into the masjid of Kufa, 900 people would be there, sitting there, saying, Haddathani Ja'far ibn Muhammad. I heard this from who? From Ja'far ibn Muhammad. There were many people who were quoting from the imam. But then there was Zurara who wouldn't sit in Kufa. There was Zurara who was to do this in the best way possible. I'm going to go to the imam. I'm going to sit in front of the imam myself. This is characteristic number one. This is why he had that type of status. Because of this work ethic. Number two, what else did Zurara do? When others came to hear the sixth imam, they came. What did they come with? They come with their ears. But Zurara didn't used to come with his ears. Zurara used to come with his writing material. That makes a world of difference. A world of difference. So the narration says when Zurara used to come and he used to be in the presence of the sixth imam, immediately he's taking notes. Now, you have to understand that at that time, paper is still not a thing. Maybe 50 years, 100 years later, paper becomes a more dominant thing in that part of the world. Yes? Still, paper is not a thing. What are they using? They're using parchments. That's animal skin. They're using maybe papyrus. Maybe they're using animal bones. Maybe they're using stones, tablets, these types of things. So you imagine the work ethic of someone who wants to come and sit in front of the sixth imam, says, I have to write it. Writing is not easy. That's not a simple thing. But this is what helped Zurara reach that point where the fifth imam and the sixth imam constantly used to pray for Zurara. Yes? And when threats were coming the direction of Zurara, the fifth and sixth imam would do things to protect him from that threat. The lesson to be learned from Zurara is the work ethic that Zurara had. We move on to the second companion, Humran ibn A'yan, the brother of Zurara. We don't know as much about Humran as we do about Zurara, and there is a reason for that. Because Humran played a role slightly different from the role of Zurara. Zurara's role was to narrate hadith from the sixth imam. What is the sixth imam preaching? I will take that and share that in other cities, mainly in Kufa, which was the main stronghold of the Shia at that time. Humran's role, slightly different. Humran was more of a logistics guy. He played the role of a wakil. That means if someone needs to get money to the sixth imam, he's going to play that. If someone has to write a letter to the sixth imam, he's going to play that role. If the sixth imam wants to get a message to his followers, he's going to do it through who? He's going to do it through his wakil, through these deputies and these representatives, yes? But interestingly enough, every time people used to come to Hajj, and the imam used to see his own companions, he would ask about who? He would ask about Humran ibn A'yan. So when people used to come to Hajj, the imam used to ask him, do you have any news of Humran? What's going on with Humran? Is his family doing well? Is he doing well? They say, yes, Yabna Rasulullah, he's doing well. He said, when you go back, send my salam to Humran. Interesting, huh? Two children, yes, two brothers, same family, amazing family. Each one of them played their own role. None of them ever came and said, why am I not doing what he's doing? How come he gets to write hadith? I want to write hadith too. How come he's doing logistics? No, everybody understood their own role. The obedience that they had to the sixth imam. If it wasn't for obedience like this, we wouldn't have a school of thought today. We wouldn't have a hadith corpus today. You understand this? The lesson from Humran is, understand your role and play that role well. Every single one of us has their own role to play. It's wrong for me to sit there and say, no, I don't want this role. I want that role. But you're not good at that role. So why don't you help in this role? No. I want that role. See, now you're creating problems. Now, every one of these individuals, obedience to the sixth imam. This is the lesson from the life of Humran.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Hali Hakim Mati.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Quran Quest, a program on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Quran Quest on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, Syed Abdullah, who accepted my invitation to come and explain and elaborate on different chapters of the Quran in this program, Quran Quest. Assalamu alaikum. Sayyid, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me, brother.
You're welcome. We've started, in fact, a series of discussions or episodes on the 23rd chapter of the Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or chapter The Believers or The Faithful. And before we move on, I need to remind our dear audience about the previous episode. If you have missed it, no worries. You can download it from our website, RIB English Radio. Just search Quran Quest. In the previous episode, we talked about the whereabouts, or the title, the name, the nomenclature, the reason of revelation, and the theme, basically, of this chapter or the revelation of this chapter. And we move on to the verses and the questions which are concerning the verses of the 23rd chapter of the Quran. But before